Hi, I'm Piper.
And I'm Erin.
Welcome to Off the Tracks podcast, where we explore what it means to do law differently. Today's episode is in partnership with Lawyers In-House. Lawyers In-House is comprised of a team of experienced former in-house counsel who are ready to hit the ground running to deliver world-class legal support that takes work off your plate and makes life easier along the way. Whether you're a solopreneur or a Fortune 500 company or fall anywhere in between, Lawyers In-House will meet and exceed your business's needs.
Today, we are joined by Deepak Iyer, who currently works as legal counsel technology at First Canadian Title Limited. We are so excited to have him on the podcast today, as it is a mini Windsor Law reunion. Deepak was a year ahead of both Piper and I at Windsor Law, and we're so excited to have him here today.
Deepak, we are so excited you are here today. We always selfishly love chatting with fellow Windsor alum. And so it's such a joy to have you join us on our in-house series, which is just so cool. It's always great to see like how people have taken the trajectory of their careers since law school, and you are no exception. And so we always love to start the podcast with the same question, which is briefly, how has your career evolved over time?
Oh, wow. Well, first, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here. I think particularly to to career as a lawyer or just career generally?
I think both. That we love to hear, you know, all of like the intricacies of it.
Sure. So I think my career to law was kind of, I think, happenstance. I was progressing towards something in business or perhaps medicine. And I spent a couple of months in India interning for a cancer organization, and fully intended to go to medical school with a backup. If that doesn't work, let's go to business school and see how things go. But my experience with medicine kind of burned a little bit in that I found it a very reactive approach to a lot of things, in that, you know, people got sick and then they came to the hospital. There was very little proactive work being done. But while I was at that organization, I kind of got exposed to the area of advocacy and like law. And I found the approach there was very, very proactive. And it kind of helped me know that I can do something in advance. I can kind of get things going. And then that sets the stage so that bad things don't happen. And that's kind of how I fell into law. Like there was no like I wanted to be a lawyer, I wanted to that's a dream of mine or anything of that kind of sort. I was told I'd be a good lawyer because I argued as a kid, but I think that is the tell-all for most of us or some of us. But yeah, so that's how I kind of fell into law. I started doing a bit more research. I started doing, how do I get here, what do I need, do I have the grades, the LSAT, like all that kind of happened in the span of like six months to a year after spending some time recovering from leaving medical school or that pathway. But yeah, and then I kind of fell into law. And then I think from law school, I fully intended to be a labor and employment lawyer. All my courses were in that direction. My undergrad thesis was on labor and employment. And then I just took an ODET course about commercial and transactional relationships, like how to draft contracts, how to read a contract, and it kind of like hooked me. And then since then, it had been a shift to trying to find some sort of like full service firm where I was able to get that experience of being a corporate lawyer, but also doing some employment, doing some labor. Once I started doing the work in articling, for the rest was history. It's just as much as I could take in corporate work, I just had a ton of fun doing that.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I always find it's interesting how articling kind of shapes, you know, you may have these interests in one area or another, but then once you actually start practicing, sometimes just something completely different takes hold of you and you just sort of end up going down that route. So that's always interesting to hear. So we know you didn't always want to go to law school, or that wasn't always initially the plan. It was sort of happenstance that you ended up doing that. But how did you end up working in-house? Was that also happenstance, or was that something you sort of had your eyes set on when you started law school?
Great question. So I think I did a bit of startup work prior to, so I knew I always wanted to kind of mix in some sort of business aspect in the way that I practiced. And like I have know members that are family or family members that are lawyers or friends that are lawyers. So I kind of didn't know that in-house existed. My first introduction to in-house is when I was articling, and then we worked in the technology space, and we worked very closely with this company's in-house counsel. And then I got to know them a little bit better. And I was like, you know what, this seems to be the best mix in that I'm able to practice as a lawyer, but also take on where I'm like the business hats and kind of take on more risk, understand the company more, and like more intimately be involved in the development of the company. And that's kind of my true introduction to in-house. But until then, I didn't know it was a thing. You know, like you're a Google lawyer or whatever, you hear these things, but there's never anything that said this is a role waiting to be filled.
No, definitely. And I think, you know, it's so interesting now. Deepak, how many years have you been called to the bar?
Ooh, 2019. So I think 4-ish.
Okay, yes. Yeah. Aaron and I were called in 2020. And it's so interesting. I'm sure you've had a similar experience where you see, you know, so many of your friends and peers making like early lateral career moves or career changes. And it all kind of happens. I mean, it happens to entire careers, but I see a lot of it happening now. I feel like also the pandemic often changed a lot of people's priorities in terms of what they were looking for in work. And so that also could have been a catalyst for all of this change. And so it's so interesting because I think, I guess the point I'm trying to make is that you see people like our year of call, our area of call, moving more in-house a lot of times, or moving into more innovative space. And not saying that law firms aren't innovative. There are many law firms doing innovative work and innovative programming within their firms, but like spaces that, you know, work in different ways. Am I making any sense?
When I found out that this is a thing, like I was working with a recruiter at that time, because I was living in Windsor for a little while with my partner, and the pandemic kind of made the shift to come back to Toronto because we went 9 or 10 months without seeing either of our parents. And it was a little bit too much than we could handle. So when I made the shift back, I had a recruiter reach out to me. I was like, hey, this position exists. And then I did a bunch of research. And what I mean by that is talk to everyone I knew was willing to accept my LinkedIn request and be like, you know, what did you do? And I think the general trend from a generation before was you want to spend at least 5 or 6 or 7 years at a firm, gain the experience. And then when you have the corporate experience or the transactional experience, jump into in-house. So you're set as a lawyer, and then now your skills that you're building are more business oriented. So that kind of scared me. But I spoke to a bunch of junior people, like people were 3, 4, 4.5, 5 years, and they're like, the industry has changed. Like, you just jump in. If you're ready to make that jump, make that jump. And it was like absolutely the right decision. You know, the fear still is there. You still deal with things you don't know. But I think the older you get, and I mean older in terms of experience, how long you've been practicing, you get more comfortable with that fear and you get more comfortable with that unknown. But I think the trend that more and more younger calls are jumping in-house is great. I think we're more directed and determined in the way that we want to build our careers, and following the traditional pathway was at one time the most correct, if you want to say it that. But I think these days, like, you have a job, like, do something you enjoy, do something you love, might as well just get into it as soon as you can. Like, why wait for that 7 years of, especially if you don't like working at a firm, you don't like the environment of a firm, go.
Yeah, that is excellent advice, especially for younger or more recent calls who may be a bit scared of making that jump so early in their career. But I really appreciate you sharing that with us. So you have also worked in a few different jurisdictions, mainly Hamilton, Windsor, Toronto. How has your experience in these various bars differed, if at all?
Great question. The reputation that smaller bars, everyone knows each other, is very true. Like, everyone in Hamilton knew each other. Everyone in Windsor knew each other. And then when you came back to Toronto, you're like, I'm on a deal with you and I'll never see you again. So I think what the small bar taught me was be nice, be polite at all the time, right? Because your reputation carries around you. And there are some people who don't believe that, who are just like, you know, run a very hardship. But as long as you're polite and you kind of do the work and then you're nice, that plays a big factor in kind of gaining this reputation. And I think that helped with my in-house ability, so to say, in that like you work for the business team. You have to learn to play nice. A lot of being in-house is saying no, but then finding out a way to make it work. But a lot of that is positioning how you say no. And it's very much like working with your words and trying to diffuse situations and trying to push your agenda at the same time, trying to balance what the other side is saying. And I think I learned a lot of that from working at these smaller bars. But the Windsor Bar and the Hamilton Bar are like outstanding. I think they're great. I think Windsor gets a very bad rap, but I think it's one of the best cities in North America and one of the best bars. Like I had, I was new to the Windsor Bar, but I had incredible mentorship from the day that I stepped into the Windsor Bar from people. I wasn't even at their firms. I got people from different firms reach out to me and be like, hey, welcome to the bar. Let me know if I can help you with anything. Like it was just incredible. And I think it's a lot harder to find that in larger bars. And that played a fundamental impact in the way that I was able to gain a lot of knowledge very quickly, because there's senior lawyers willing to help junior lawyers because they see it as their, you know, responsibility or their duty. And that's kind of how I wanted to build my career when I got a bit more seniors, you know, help out the younger folks, because it's terrifying when you're young and you don't know what's happening and you get an email and you're like, I don't even know how to respond to this, right? Like that hand holding is so helpful. And I found that immensely in Hamilton and in especially in Windsor.
Aaron, this is why I love having Windsor alum come on the podcast, because Aaron and I agree. Like we think, you know, Windsor, I mean, everyone that goes to Windsor Law knows that Windsor is a city in general. That's a bit of a bad rap. And I loved Windsor and I articled in Windsor. So I started my career in the Windsor Bar and I loved the city and I completely agree with you. The bar is small and Aaron articled in Hamilton. And so we've been in both of those spaces. Right. And I completely agree with you. And I think it's, you know, an experience that people definitely shouldn't overlook, because there are so many interesting niche opportunities that, not to say that you wouldn't get elsewhere, but you might experience them in a different way in those smaller bars.
Or even sooner. I think working in a small bar, people think you work in a small bar like Windsor and Hamilton, you're not exposed to complicated things. And I think that's just not true. Like the stuff that I was doing in Hamilton, I proportionally, like I don't know many colleagues were doing the same things so soon, right, in the Toronto bar. So when I was in Hamilton, like getting into the energy space, but like getting in front of the IESO and negotiating with the IESO, like those are reserved for senior counsel. But the smaller bar means there's less manpower, so you get direct access to a lot more interesting work. And same thing with Windsor. I think I was exposed to a lot more things, a lot more complicated things, a lot sooner. There was a lot more responsibility placed on you, but that was back-ended by support, right? So you kind of like you're thrown in, but you're also like followed in at the same time to can help you keep you up, which I thought was great. I think. It's kind of what you want to build, right? If you are just looking for a job and you want to do really interesting work, I wouldn't knock out a small bar, because people think Bay Street is where you go to do your interesting work. And I did end up on Bay Street when I came back to Toronto, and it's just as complicated. The only difference is, you know, there's one or two zeros that are the difference.
Oh, Deepak, that's a very funny way of putting it. No, and I think all of the comments you've made are so astute. And I think too, like, I work with a lot of law students and, in general, you know, sometimes people can be fearful to like go to practice in those smaller bars, that it's going to limit their career. And you're a perfect example of how it maybe in some ways really helped your career flourish in the way that you'd wanted, and also allowed you to find, you know, to prioritize things in your personal life. Like for example, moving closer to your family, those types of opportunities became available to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what is beneficial is there's Windsor alum everywhere, right? And Windsor alum generally view other Windsor alum favorably, right? So like when I left Windsor, I never faced the question of, oh, you worked in Windsor. The interview questions are like, oh, you lived in Windsor. Oh, you're a fellow Windsor alum. Like how, you know, do you remember, is this professor still there? Or is this this lawyer still in the arena? Like he taught my ex class, right? It's never been, or I never viewed it or faced where it was detrimental in any way, right? Like I moved from Hamilton to Windsor to move in with my partner. So like there was a reason why I moved in and we left for the same reason. But at no interview I've kind of been exposed to anything that's truly negative. And you know, if you do face something negative, then that's not the place I think you'd want to spend your time, right? Like that to me, that flag popping up that early is a great sign to not spend your time there if they view these kinds of things detrimentally.
That is a great reminder too, that if they look at you in some sort of way, then that's probably not the space for you, and better to know at the outset than to, you know, dig your time in and unfortunately waste a lot of time with those sorts of people. So that's a good reminder.
Yeah, I mean, the difficulty is like sometimes you don't have an option, but at least you're walking in with eyes wide open. At least you know, like, hey, you know, I need this job, and you know, I don't have articling, or I've done my articling, I've been called. The only place is interviewing is this place. They've said this comment. If you have the privilege of not being able to take that position, don't. But if that's something that you need, I think it's better to walk in eyes wide open than not.
Yeah, exactly. At least you can then make some internal plans for next moves, or have
exactly
something.
Best position yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So what do you most enjoy about working in-house? And what, if anything, do you miss about private practice?
So I think the most interesting and fun is also the most scary is to wear these multiple hats. And I think as lawyers, we are taught to be perfect. And in-house doesn't exist in perfection. It exists in getting it done as quickly as you can and the best you can. And sometimes very oftentimes you can't go with perfect, even though like I spent the first 3 years, everything needed to be perfect because the client wants it perfect. And then you go in-house and you try to do perfect. You just don't have time to do that, right? At the same time, you have to wear a business hat. You can't just say this doesn't work. You have to come up with ways to make it work or to mitigate it or try to find a creative way to allow for this to happen, because a lot of things happen in gray areas. And the answer no is easy. It's a lot more difficult to say yes. And then when the business comes back to you with, okay, we want to try this, you didn't have to figure out how to make that work. That is scary. At least I find it scary in the beginning, but that's what makes it most fun for me. Like I do a lot of time or spend a lot of time researching non-legal things to be like, you know, what is the industry? How is the industry moving? How is the industry changing? Like, what is the anticipated, like, how are people reading this? Because that plays a big part of how you have to advise, right? So it's not just reading the law. You have to be relatively abreast on just the general environment of the area you're working in. In terms of what I miss, like I miss my colleagues. I think in-house, I have more colleagues now. I'll say that, like I work at a company with 1,200 people. Like I wasn't at a firm that had that many colleagues. But I think what I miss in terms of that is I miss commiserating with some of my colleagues in a law firm, right? I think this is a very pre-COVID response in that you stand outside your office and you'll have a conversation and, you know, it's been 2 hours and you're kind of talking through different points. You're talking about law and then you end up having a drink or lunch. Not to say that doesn't happen in-house, but it doesn't happen as frequently because at least the team that I'm in is a lot smaller and we're just kind of very pressed for time. I think that's the most that I missed. But also the firms that I've been at, I've had excellent colleagues, right? So I think they just set a really high bar for what I was looking for. And like I absolutely miss people from Miller Canfield and from George Street and from Josh's firm. Like they're just astounding to be around. They became the thing of like their family is a weird thing to say in this environment, but I think they like, I view Josh as like an older brother because he was just so great with his mentorship and so great with like pointed advice. So I think that's something I definitely miss from working in at a firm.
And so Deepak, just so we have a little bit of context, what is like the structure of the legal team that you work within at FCT?
So we have, I think, a total of 16 lawyers, but they're split into different teams, like because we're a title insurance company at our core. We have our claims lawyers, we have our underwriting lawyers, and then we have me and a smaller team that is the corporate team. So I'm one of two junior lawyers, and my role focuses on anything and everything technology. Like while we are a fundamentally real estate based company, we do a lot of, we leverage a lot of data, a lot of technology to back end that real estate line of business. So anything that touches technology, whether it's APIs or softwares or any of those kinds of things, that's where I come in. And then my counterpart is negotiating those insurance, those corporate insurance agreements. And I have my boss who is the head of corporate, and then his boss who is the head of legal risk and compliance. So it's a four team corporate team, but with a larger group of lawyers who do claims and underwriting and things like that.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense, because it's just helpful to understand sort of the structures that exist at these different places, because one, I would have no idea that the company has 1200 employees or that they have a team of 16 lawyers. And sometimes it's just hard to know exactly what an in-house role looks like. And hopefully through this series, we'll get to have a better snapshot of the different types of in-house roles, because just like working in a law firm, there's different types of structures and different types of expertise and roles. Like you mentioned, you're in the corporate sphere. So it's just always helpful to get a better picture of that. So we really appreciate it. So a question we have for you is, did law school help prepare you for a role in tech law?
No. I don't think there are many tech courses. I think the course I took with the Odette professor, and I took one with Lee Axford, who taught contract drafting, were the most useful as a generalist corporate lawyer. The tech work was more experience. Like once I gained more experience, I kind of got more and more knowledge. But law school, it doesn't prepare you for the realities of legal work. But it, like, knowledge is great, like secure transactions, like all those courses are great. But when you start applying it, when you start practicing it, like they fall so short. And that's why I'm a huge advocate, irrespective of whether or not you do litigating, is to do clinic work, because it gets you to teach, or it teaches you communication skills. It teaches you how to think, how to do your research in a very practical way. And Aaron and I, like, we did the ADR competition, like do stuff like that, where you're able to kind of get practical experience without sitting in a classroom and someone's just reading slides to you. I think that is more useful as a general lawyer, right? Because I think when you come in, why the general thing of 5 years is difficult, because it's exponentially difficult each year, because it's, you're just exposed to so many things. But I think you can prepare yourself a little bit, notwithstanding that the it's a very sliding scale in terms of how difficult law is, at least in the beginning.
No, definitely. And so Deepak, for people listening, and also for us, because I just want to confirm, did you do a joint JD MBA?
No.
Okay. So when you were at Odette, was that in your undergrad at Windsor?
No. So there are courses at Windsor Law you can take with Odette, which is the business school. So there were, one of the courses was like a specialized business course taught by, I think his name was Professor Warren Keller, who was an Odette MBA prof, but taught a Windsor Law course. But it was a mix of MBA students and law students. But you can also take business courses at Odette and have them apply as your extra credits at Windsor Law, which I think is also super helpful if you want to progress in the corporate arena.
No, that's so interesting, because I think that not a lot of people would know that. You know, I've heard of it before, like students taking a course in an external faculty. I've learned this recently, that this is something people do in law school sometimes, but I don't think it's like widely advertised, especially if it's not a typical course offering. I know that the courses with the ones at Odette you were talking about were more somewhat typical aligned and adjacent to the law school, but No, that's super neat. So Deepak, you, something that's really interesting is like you've been called for 4-ish years, as we've determined, and you've made approximately like 4 transitions thus far in your career. What have those transitions taught you?
That it's okay to take risk. I think when I made my first jump from Hamilton to Windsor, you know, I always talk to people like I want to get a second set of opinions because you just don't know what you don't know. And a lot of the conversations were, hey, you know, do you want to make this move? Like it's very early and you move into a brand new bar and, you know, we don't know if the work was going to be interesting or, you know, and the same thing when I left Windsor to come back to Toronto and the same thing when I left Toronto to go in-house. It's scary, but I think it's worth it. Like it taught me how to handle risk. It taught me how to handle criticism. It also taught me that the amount of work you put in pays off. So when I jumped into the Windsor bar, like I felt like I needed to prove myself a little bit. I don't know whether it's necessary, but it just, to me, it shows that, you know, I'm able to translate a couple of things that I've learned through the years. But all in all, like it's okay to take risks because like we spend a lot of time doing this. Might as well enjoy what we're doing, right? Like law takes up a lot of minutes in a day. Like spend those minutes doing what you want to do and everything else is just noise. Like in the long term, like I see myself staying at FCT for a while. In 15 years, these questions of like you jump 4 times in 3 years in the beginning of your career aren't going to come up. And if they do, like, you know, it is what it is. But every jump I've made has been an exponential progression in experience, right? Jumping to Miller Canfield was huge. Jumping to Josh was huge. Jumping to FCT, I've just like learned an insane amount of knowledge. And like, I don't regret making these jumps, but it is scary. I can't deny that it's not scary.
No, and that's so important because I've spoken to some people and like close friends of mine who have been scared to make those jumps because, you know, there's that idea that, oh, well, you should really stay in a job for at least a year. And if you don't stay in the job for at least a year, it looks bad or it reflects negatively on you or it shows that you're hard to work with. And I think you've just really proven through this conversation that that's complete bullshit. Like that's totally, totally not true. And as you talked about earlier, like in one of our first parts of the conversation, you talked about like how perspectives have evolved. Like there isn't that same, you have to stay and you have to do M&As for 5 years before transitioning in-house. And so I think this is similar, that those transitions aren't a bad thing. And if anything, they're like, they give you all of these cool superpowers that you wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah, I think a big part of that is also like running through your options, right? Like if you're jumping too soon, like it is a thing. I want to caveat that by saying like, think through the option of jumping, right? Like don't do 4 jumps in a year because, you know, there are negative things that can come as a result of that. But if you're able to justify to yourself, you know, the change here is that I'm jumping into an area of law that I'm really interested in practicing, or the lawyer at this firm is someone I really want to work with, and the other side, the firm I'm at now is very toxic and it's not great for my mental health. That's a reason that's worth it to jump, right? As long as you can justify that to yourself and it's tied to some sort of rationality, I think do it. Who cares what someone else thinks, right? As long as like you land somewhere where you're comfortable and you're pushed and you're earning a figure that you're comfortable earning, do it. Life's too short and a career is too long to sit at a place you don't want to be at.
That is also excellent advice. We are just getting lots of wise words of wisdom, so I really appreciate it. But I guess, so kind of looking back a bit, is there a moment or a setback that you can think of that, you know, at the time really challenged you, but now you kind of look back on it as something that really helped push you in the right direction or helped you grow to where you are today?
Not necessarily like one or two things or even a handful of things. I think what making mistakes was a big part of my career early on. And like, you know, when you're young, you make blunders. And it just seems as if like you walk up and like, I'm getting fired. Like there's no way I still have a job when I'm done this meeting. But I think making those mistakes are such key things to not, it teaches you, but like, okay, what can I learn from this? What can I do? And how do I not make that mistake again? Cause like, I remember making a mistake in my first year and it felt like I'd been punched in the stomach. Like I was going to throw up. And then I was like, I'm getting fired. Like this is a huge blunder. And then my boss was like, everything is fixable except for limitation periods. And even that too is potentially fixable. And that kind of sat with me. And I was like, anything that goes wrong, we can fix, right? For the most part, we can fix. And that kind of set me up for spending time at Miller Canfield and working in Toronto. It was like, I'm going to make mistakes. Like that's perfectly okay. And it's your boss's responsibility to also help catch that mistake and to kind of coach you through that mistake. And you just have to learn from it. You know, you just have to not do that again. But because when you're young, you don't even know what you don't know, and you think you know things and it's likely wrong or it's likely different, that's okay. And that's kind of how I frame my in-house career now. Like we make mistakes here, but how do we fix it? Like focus on let's fixing it. The internal anxiety and like you feel sweaty when you're sitting and being like, oh, we made a mistake. Okay, let's turn the conversation to how do we fix this? I think you learn a bit of resilience the more mistakes that you make, and some are small. Like in the beginning, the smallest mistakes will hurt you, and eventually you're like, whatever, like, you know, it is what it is. And then you make bigger mistakes, and then those will seem small in a couple of months or a couple of years, and then you make bigger mistakes. As long as you're learning from those mistakes and changing and reframing the way you're approaching it, I think that's great. But that's something that's really helped me, because in the beginning I was like, oh no, but now it's okay, how do we fix this?
No, that's so spot on. And I know what you mean. I think everyone, regardless of their career path, has had those moments where they think, oh my gosh, I'm going into this meeting and I'm going to get fired. And then it's like, I'm completely about something else. I definitely have had those moments in life. I think most people have, and it's so nerve-wracking, especially, you know, law still in a lot of ways, it's very hierarchical. And especially when you're starting off in your career, it can be really scary to, you know, make those little mishaps, those little mistakes, to miss something. Sometimes it's not even a mistake. Sometimes it's just like, you know, we all say we're so detail oriented and in our cover letters, but you still miss things. Like we're all human. Yeah. So, no, that's so astute. So thank you so much, Deepak. I think something that we're curious about, and we'd love to hear your perspective on, because everything you've shared so far is just illuminating and like really reassuring. And we know this is a broad question, so feel free to take it any direction you'd like to take it. But what do you think something that needs to change in the legal profession is?
I think we need to, like, there's always chat about mentorship, but like, I think we need to spend more time advocating. And what I mean by that is mentorship is not just, hey, let me help you with this. Mentorship is, let me put you in the right positions for you to excel. And what I mean by that, I have a specific example that happened this morning. Like my boss was like, he called me. He's like, I think you need to be on this meeting because it puts you in front of the CEO. I think that's great exposure. That is not that common, because I find at larger firms, people pay for the partner. So you do all of the work, and then the partner takes the credit, or the partner, or they have to sometimes, it's not always their fault. They have to own that product. But I think a part of that is also showcasing that it was the junior associate or the senior associate that did that work, so they can gain their own kind of presence at the firm or presence in front of the client. And I think that needs to be done a lot more. Sharing your success needs to be done a lot more. And that is a very selfish thing that I view, because I think that isn't done as frequently, because I think mentorship is often seen as like career advice or like personal advice. Like, oh, I'm really scared here. What do I do? I think that is a lot more easily done and more frequently done. Though that being said, it should be done more. I think people should focus on celebrating your colleagues and celebrating their associates a lot more. And on top of that, I think we need to better prep law students to be lawyers. And part of that is, like, I had no idea. I was very naive when I went into law school, and I was very naive walking out of law school too, in that this is the traditional pathway. I think we need to do better in telling students more of the world, right? Like, for some reason, clinic work isn't seen as prestigious, but like getting into Parkdale Legal Services or LAW is difficult, right? Like, that's a great position to be in. Like, you're getting so much exposure to such like people's intimate lives, and you're making decisions, and you're providing advice that affects them in a great level. I think we have to do better to expose students to that. And the other part is expose students to financial planning and financial responsibilities. Like, how do I pay off my debt? What options do I have? Do I need to pay off my debt? Because when I joined Windsor Law, I got a letter saying, go to Scotiabank and get your student line of credit. And I was like, okay, what? Like, what do I do now? And I went in, they're like, sign this form, you get 80 grand, it's this percent. And I was like, whoa, this is a lot. Like, what happens after? And then they give like a 50 page document, which I had to sit down and read to understand my repayment schedule, right? And like, wealth planning is something that needs to be taught as well. And I think at law school, there's a lot more we can get at law school that sets you up in a better way when you're a junior lawyer, or when you're just beginning out. So like, then all you kind of have to focus on is surviving and kind of doing your work without having to think about, okay, so if I need to do this, then I get this much off my debt payment, or OSAP is this. Like, that needs to just be handed over, because it's easily available as a school. And let the Articling students focus on just the work.
Oh, I feel like we could do a whole podcast episode about everything, or like five, about everything you just said. I originally was going to jump in because you were talking about like mentorship, and you were talking about, you know, having mentors place you in front of the right people and speak your name in rooms of opportunities. And it's really interesting because we had a guest on the podcast last year, Sandra Scheim. I think it was episode 45. And she talked a lot about the difference between mentorship and sponsorship. Right. And so mentorship was what you spoke about, you know, like the career advice, and this is what happened to me, this is what you could expect, blah, blah, blah. But sponsorship was that, hey, I think like I'm going to introduce you to this person, or I'm going to take you for lunch, and we're going to go with my friend who's in this career, and this is what you want to do. And, or, you know, calling you in the way that your colleague did and said, I think you need to be in this meeting. And I think that's so important. But then now I'm also thinking about, you're talking about wealth planning in law school, and all the things you have to worry about when you leave law school that are just beyond the scope of articling and existing as a human with, now, if you've taken on this debt load, which Aaron and I both have, and we've talked about this extensively before on the podcast. But damn, Deepak, I am not qualified to run it, but I would love if, like, in law schools, there were, you know, like how we have so many interesting lunch and learns in law school, if there was like a lunch and learn with financial advisors. And like, no offense to Scotiabank, who owns me for the rest of my life, but I don't really want the Scotiabank advisor. Like, I want like a non-partisan, impartial person to come in, and preferably more than one, preferably people with different perspectives. Wow. This is a cool idea.
It's not even those wealth planners, it's practitioners, right? Yeah. There are people who work at a clinic who still have debt. There are people who went to a large firm for the sole purpose of paying off debt. There are people who work at small firms who paid off debt quicker than some people who went to the clinic industry. Like, I think getting this varied exposure is also important, just to know that there's more than one pathway, right? Like, when people say, oh, he went to big law to pay off debt, like, that's one pathway. There's so many different kinds of pathways you can take. Just getting exposure to that, because I think we focus very much on the one way and the traditional way. I think it's important to know that there's different ways to do different things. Like, it can take someone 25 years to pay off debt because they have two dependents. It's not going to take me 25 years to pay off my debt because I don't have dependents, right? Like, it's all over the place. People who have kids, people who take care of their families, they have to support someone else. They're taking a job, they live in a high cost city, live in a low cost city. Like, there's all these different factors. And I think getting exposure to that is also key, knowing that there is no right way, but there is a way. And I think that's important to let students know, because that drives a lot of people's push towards Bay Street, because they go, when I was in law school, this might date me a little bit, it was $1,400 a week to get onto Bay Street. And you're like, okay, so rent on Toronto is at that time, $1,500 a month. And then that gives me this much to put towards my debt. And then if you know, like, if I just extend that for 7 years, I can take a job that pays a little bit less, but something that I love so much more. I don't have to go into Bay Street to pay off debt. I just want to say, like, this is shrouded in a lot of privilege, but I think knowing your options is also key.
Yeah, that is super helpful. And I think sometimes, yeah, Bay Street gets touted as like, oh, okay, yeah, you can just go and you can pay off your debt and you can just live that life. But sometimes, like, that doesn't necessarily always mean that you're going to be able to pay off your debt quickly. Like you said, you could have dependents, you could have a different financial situation, you could get sucked into that like high rolling lifestyle. And just because you have a high paying job doesn't mean that you're necessarily managing your money well. So it really depends. And it would be so helpful to hear from other practitioners on how they've managed debt and how it's played into their sort of career changes and career choices. And so on that note, just like a subtle plug for our own podcast on our podcast, but our student debt series is a great way to like hear different stories about how people have managed those things. But we have so enjoyed having you here, Deepak. It's been like Windsor Law reunion. We love it. But we always like to end the podcast with the same question, which is, what is something new that you've learned recently?
In law or outside of law?
Either or. And whatever.
In law, I've learned that I'm still often wrong, but I need to and I have to trust my gut feeling a lot more. I think that's something that I keep learning and I keep disbelieving, but I have to trust my gut feeling. I think that applies personally as well. I think that's something that we just have to continue doing. Because if it's poking at you, it's poking at you for a reason.
Amazing. Deepak, that is so true. And we are just so grateful for like all of your insights today. And I think what this has really proven is that like, it is so possible to make really big, impactful moves early in your career and to move with intention, which it's really clear that you've done. So thank you for sharing your experiences with us today. We so appreciate you being here and we cannot wait to follow along with all of the successes that you continue to have throughout what we know will be a very long and wonderful career.
Thanks, Barbara. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me, Erin.
Thank you again to our partner, Lawyers in House, a law firm composed of former in-house counsel. To learn more, visit lawyersinhouse.com to see how they can provide insightful, pragmatic, and solutions-focused legal services to you and your legal department.